From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in the days following the mass shooting in Buffalo, where an 18-year-old gunman is accused of killing 10 people at a top supermarket. The attack was racially motivated, as news organizations have reported since Saturday's attack. The gunman wrote a 180-page screed filled with white supremacist ideologies and references to what's referred to as the Great Replacement Theory. I mean, it's bunk, as we've talked about this week on the program, but it is pervasive in some communities of thought, especially online, and increasingly in mainstream politics. Now, it's sad to say that, as often happens following tragedies of this nature, questions about mental illness are raised, but mental health experts are warning the public not just to jump straight there and not to conflate racism with mental illness. They worry that using mental illness as an excuse for white supremacy will stigmatize people who struggle with actual mental health issues, and it might be just a convenient way of sort of waving away what happened as opposed to drilling down into understanding it better. On top of all of this is the question of coping and how people who have been devastated by this terrorist attack are dealing and what they need. This is an ongoing conversation, and we're grateful for these guests this hour who are with us in studio. Samantha Colson is Director of Training and Programs at NAMI Rochester. Welcome. Thank you for being with us here.
Thank you for having me.
And Whitney Young is Marketing and Events Manager for NAMI Rochester. Welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you very much.
Samantha, let me just start with you and just ask you, can I just kind of get a snapshot of where your mind was watching some of these events unfold this weekend?
Yeah, so my husband and I were actually in Connecticut picking up our oldest son from college. So as it made national news, and we were in the hotel just scanning through channels, that came on, very much shocking, very much devastating to the both of us, and heartbreaking, just to see that this is happening yet again in our community so close to home.
Is there any initial reaction that goes in any direction? I think what I'm getting at here is, we talked to a state senator earlier this week who's from Buffalo, who said the first thing he was thinking was, you know, we've got to do better with mental health. We've got to do better with mental health. I wonder if that's the kind of thing, given your work, does that come to mind immediately for you in an event like this?
No, not for me specifically. Given recent events across the country, given recent events in our own history as a country, we really need to be holding in mind the set of values that we have and the set of values that we express on a national platform, whether that's social media, whether that's in groups that we're in, and the messaging that we share with very impressionable minds. And by impressionable minds, I don't mean someone who's 18, folks who feel like they don't have any connections, feels like they are at a loss, and these are the only groups of people that they can find comfort in. So again, holding all of those things in mind for me specifically, no, not connecting it directly to mental health or mental illness, but really the state that we're in as a country and how we need to combat racism and stand up against racism as allies and what that looks like.
Yep, and we'll talk about that a lot this hour. Whitney, you have done work in media. You understand communication. And now, of course, working with NAMI, there's a lot of things that sort of overlap here. But what comes to mind for you first when you hear some of the discourse about this weekend's terrorist attack?
I mean, I think my first thought is simply that racism is not mental illness. It's a core belief that can exist alongside mental illness or a mental health condition in certain individuals as a result of environmental factors. But to say that racism or racist beliefs are the result or a symptom of a mental illness is just categorically false. And, again, at NAMI Rochester, we do tireless work to deconstruct and undo the stigma surrounding mental illness, and conversations like this just perpetuate it.
Do they strike you as well-intended, but maybe I can understand why some people would say no one would pick up a gun and go do that unless they were mentally ill. I can understand the well-intended folks who would say, well, you got to be mentally ill to be that deeply racist. So I think there probably is, I'm trying to be generous, some good intention, but there's probably also a little bit of sort of craven opportunism here, just saying, hey, you know, that's what this is all about. Let's not turn our attention to other more deeply rooted problems. So how do you see those kind of conflicting ideas there?
Yeah, I think it's certainly much easier to pardon systemic racism as, oh, well, it's just that's a mental health issue. It's not something that we as politicians and policy makers have to address. You know, it's sort of the lazy out to just sort of put it on the mental health system and mental health providers and step away from it.
So there's an event coming up this weekend, and listeners, we'll take your feedback as we think about mental health. I'm wondering how your mental health is. We do want to talk about coping and support for people who need it, especially in the Black community. But there's, you know, this hits people in a lot of different ways. And if you want to email the program, we'll take your emails at connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And the event coming up on Saturday, well, Whitney, can you take us through it? What's coming up?
Yes, absolutely. So this is our biggest fundraising event of the year. It's our 10th annual NAMI Rochester Walk, and the first time that we're in person since 2019, pre-pandemic. So we're very excited about that. This is also the first time that we are hosting a festival, a mental health festival, in addition to the walk itself, which starts at 10. So the event in its entirety is from 9 to noon at the Village Gate. And it's free to attend, free to register to walk. And we hope everyone will stop by and just sort of help us celebrate mental health and wellness in our community.
Samantha, let's start with the event from this last weekend, how you do try to understand it. As opposed to just jumping to mental health, how do we try to understand what motivates someone to do something like that? And maybe what can we learn from that?
It's complex when we talk about trying to understand the mind or the brain of someone who believes something completely different from what you might believe in or what you might engage in. So it's very complex, but something for us to understand and to really lean into right now in this moment is empathy for those that we've lost, empathy for those families, empathy for that community. How can we be with these individuals in this very dark place that they're in right now, this tragic and traumatic loss that they've experienced, really leaning into empathy for them. And as far as the individual that has done this heinous crime and this heinous act, not so much empathy for him, but realizing that this type of evil in this world does exist. And what are things that we can do to really get along with each other, to really debunk any of these myths or rumors that we have, and just spreading accurate facts and information?
There's something that Whitney said that strikes me as really important here. Yes, people who are racist, people who end up murdering others, can suffer from mental illness, of course. But those things can also sort of exist in parallel. You also can develop an ideology of deep racism that in your own view, your own sort of construction is logical and rational because of what you have consumed and experienced and thought about. In other words, it's not just a mental breakdown that all of a sudden there's something wrong. I mean, of course there's something wrong. I mean, I hope we can generally agree on that. But I think in terms of the function of the way the mind works, this person may have, and I'm not talking about one individual, we don't know, there's still a lot we don't know, but you can operate in a way that you think is rational, as hard as that is to hear. Can you talk to me a little bit about, because I think there are some listeners going, there's no way, who could do this to others?
So one of the things that we always like to shine a light on when we talk about statistics for individuals who live with a mental illness, the percentage is really low for individuals who lean into acts of violence and also have a mental illness. I want to say the percentage is something like 4% or less. So individuals who live with mental illness are more likely to be on the receiving end of a violent act, not more likely to commit a violent act. So just wanting to put that out there as well. Also, people often confuse aggression and violence as the same thing. So those are two different things, whereas certain mental illnesses have a category or a preface where aggression is more prominent, but not violent. So we want to separate those two. The other piece to that is making sure that individuals understand that, as we've said, racism is not a mental illness. And what about those individuals that do live with mental illness, as Whitney said? That stigmatizing piece that goes along with that, them feeling as though now I'm going to be looked at as I'm violent. No one's going to want to be around me because I'm going to lean into these acts and do these heinous crimes. So just wanting to separate those two and share with the public that statistically speaking, there's a misalignment there with how things are portrayed in the media and movies with how individuals living with mental illness are.
Yeah, and so let me ask both of you, one of the sort of extensions on this is I think about our listeners all throughout the Finger Lakes region, the Southern Tier, listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio or various platforms. And frankly, you know, we don't cover those areas enough, and that's still an ongoing goal, and we're always open to doing more, and we're going to do more. But I think when you absorb what Samantha Colson just said, the idea that if there's someone in your family, if you have a child, like people, most people don't want to think of themselves as racist. I understand the gunman on Buffalo did, but most people don't, even if racism is sort of a spectrum and there's a lot of complicity and that's a whole other thing. But most people don't want to say, oh yeah, my kid is racist, or my family member is, or my father is, or my friend is. And I think the idea that I'm hearing from you is, don't just assume, well, hey, they don't have mental illness. Like, they're not racist. They don't think of the world in this terrible way. As opposed to saying, racism is learned and absorbed. It has historical roots. It's pernicious, and you know, it's something that's going to take a lot of work to root out. But it's just because your heart is good, or you think your heart is good, or you consider yourself a kind person, and I hope most people are, that doesn't mean that there can't be racism sort of around you. Does that make sense?
That is very accurate. And we all come to the table with our own implicit biases, the things that we believe, our own lived experience, and well-intentioned and well-meaning ways of being. That's just us as humans. But the next step is, okay, now that I know that there are these ideologies, now that I know that I come to the table and I may not agree or like this particular population or this particular community, or I've learned this stigmatizing thing or this racist way of being, whether it's through family, whether it's through consumption of things that I read and that I see, it's that acknowledgement and then doing something with that acknowledgement to change it. Because we all come to the table with something, and self-awareness is key to being able to move through that.
What do you think, Whitney?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think another part of this too, just in general, talking about the idea, you know, you said earlier, how could this person not have a mental illness to do something like this? And I think one of the points that I wanted to bring attention to is the fact that a lot of disorders have symptoms like delusions and obsessions and paranoia. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, when racism coexists with a mental illness, a psychotic disorder, something like that, or antisocial personality disorder, that is a lot of the time when you see those two things kind of fuse together. And it's that perfect storm of, you know, something horrifying like this happening.
I've also been thinking a lot about loneliness recently. Mm-hmm. And some of the writings of Hannah Arendt, who was a Holocaust survivor and one of the 20th century's a political philosopher who had significant amount of influence. And Hannah Arendt wrote about loneliness as a possible precursor to sort of accepting totalitarianism. And I guess the reason I'm thinking about that is this. This is a lonely time in the world right now. And I don't mean to like make these grand pronouncements, but we are connected with technology in ways that we've never been connected, and yet we don't have to see anybody. You can shop from home, never see anybody. You can buy groceries from home, never go to a store. You can take classes from home, never see someone in person. We had a pandemic that's ongoing that separated us for a long, long time. So we think we are connected, but in many ways we're less connected. And communities are less so. You know, I don't go to church, but I certainly see the value of religious institutions and what they bring, how they bring people together, communities, neighborhoods, associations. I mean, even my mother jokes that, you know, growing up, if the doorbell rang, it's like, oh, who's stopping over? And now it's like, oh, what is going on here? It's like we're suspicious of any visitor. So what we may not see, and I think it's affected me, like my mental health in the last year has just been the worst it's ever been, I think. And I have family members with depression. I don't that I know of, but I definitely have been more in touch with my own sort of sadness and, you know, sometimes despair or worry. And I think about what that makes us susceptible to, because if you're not finding community where we used to find it, will you find it in the Reddits and the 4chans and these communities that tell you, here's why you're not happy. Here's, you know, I'm not trying to make a pat explanation for the Buffalo mass shooting, but I am worried about what loneliness leads to and what we are susceptible to, who we will listen to if we don't feel connected. And I wonder if you both have thoughts about that and maybe what we can do about that.
Yeah, it's definitely about connection and being with other people. And for some folks, I mean, if you have family that are in different regions and different areas, this is a great way of being, because now you're able to connect with them in ways that you weren't able to before when you couldn't see them and touch them in person. So yes, there's benefits and there's risks to having all of these new waves of technologies and ways that we go about our daily lives now. But I would also add that having that connection, being involved with the people around you in your immediate circle, seeing them physically, being able to even just ask them, how are you doing? How are things going? Asking those questions and checking in with them. That's all part of being in relationship. That's all part of connection. And yes, if you're not getting that, if that need isn't met in your immediate group or the immediate folks that you are with, you're going to start to find that in other places. If you even think about gangs, like if I don't have that connection with my family, my friends, these people are taking me in. Sure. They're feeding me this. I feel welcomed. I feel like I belong. And that's where that all comes from. Everyone wants to belong somewhere. They want to be connected. And if this is how I'm going to get that need met, unfortunately, I feel like that is how this individual was able to get that need met.
What do you think, Whitney?
I mean, we know for a fact that belonging, the sense of belonging, is one of our most basic needs as human beings. And so, unfortunately, when young people or people of any age don't find that, or when they are rejected by the social groups that they try to be a part of, you know, whether it's in school or something like that, that isolation does lead them to, as you said, the 4chans and the Reddits mm-hmm. and the Discord servers and all of those places. And even if it's evil and horrible, the groups that are willing to give them that sense of belonging, it's a need, it's a survival need, so they're likely going to accept it.
Yeah, and maybe sort of the aggressive recruiting that happens is kind of evil and horrible, but if you're on the receiving end of that and you're lonely, you start to form beliefs that you don't mm-hmm. consider to be evil or horrible. You start thinking, well, that's logical. And everybody's needs is a little different. I mean, certainly Hannah Arendt herself said that she enjoyed the solace of many of her later years, but her observation was, I think exactly what Whitney's saying is, we do have a need to belong in to something. I mean, like there's nobody, I don't think, who doesn't need to feel like they belong somewhere. You know, that means different things for many, many different people. I just don't know how we sort of get kind of reconnected in more healthy ways. Do you?
I mean, I think, you know, one of our primary initiatives at NAMI Rochester is that we provide no-cost open support groups to the community for a variety of different needs. And so whether you're someone who lives with a mental health condition, or you have a family member that lives with a mental health condition, or you just need a safe space to go and talk and connect with folks, that is literally something we provide, because we see that as the foundation for not only a mentally healthy community, but just a healthy community in general, a well community in mm-hmm. general.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I would agree. And also partnering with other local community agencies to really bring in more individuals who otherwise would not be out and about, that need that space to be able to talk and communicate and connect, continuing to offer that on a rolling basis.
Well, let's just remind you then, one great place to be connected to people is in person, out moving around, walking. And there's an event coming up, the 10th annual NAMI Rochester Walk and Festival now. On Saturday, starts at 9 a.m. More information there, Whitney?
Yes, it does. It starts at 9 a.m. The walk is at 10 a.m. It's about a mile in length, so not too strenuous. We hope it's accessible to a lot of people. We also have Senator Samra Brouk, who is going to be making an opening statement, kind of proclamation at the beginning, right around 10 a.m. as well, and it goes right up until noon.
Okay. More information where? Where do they find more information?
You can find more information, I would say, primarily on our social media at NAMI Rochester NY on Instagram, and also namirock.org is our website.
And NAMI is NAMI.
That's right.
An email from a phone number. I don't have a name here, but I'm going to read the email. Evan, it seems to me that anyone who feels they have to take violent action, such as picking up a gun, and has to start shooting people, must at least be extremely afraid of something. Would it not make equal sense to find a way to more directly identify what those deeper fears are and address them to help prevent them from feeling so scared that they become racist or influence others to become racist in the first place? It's a thought. Samantha, what do you think?
Well, we know that there is fear that comes from racism, the fear of, for him, that, you know, the white population is going to diminish and black and brown people will take over. So that was a deep fear of his. So yes, fear often plays into that, whatever it stems from, wherever it comes from. And it is about breaking through some of those silos and, again, spreading correct information, factual information. I think it's going to be really impossible to get rid of all of these dark holes and places where folks are able to share this information. But if we can at least unite on a larger front, a national front around what is right, what is wrong, what our country believes, what we believe in, that's a great place to start.
Is there a line in which fear crosses into something more clinical? I don't know if phobia is the word or something like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are many diagnoses where that comes into play. But again, those are criteria and diagnoses that need to be done by a professional. So that's something where someone would have to do lots of examination and questions and going through to make sure that this individual actually has or meet the criteria for that diagnosis.
And the tricky and the really precarious part as it relates to this situation with potential violence is, first of all, most of the people we're talking about are not going to want to submit to sort of any sort of examination, discussion, even talking about it. And you got to have people around you who are in touch with how you're doing, checking in. I tried to, I wanted to read and understand where the gunman is coming from. I don't want to share that stuff. But it's out there, sadly, and it's going to be shared. And, you know, he wrote about how he lied to his family and lied about going to college and lied about where he was. And so it matters to be in touch so you can check in. But I know it can be tricky. I think that means real consistent relationships, right? I mean, check-ins are great, but like consistent. I'm trying to think of some way to kind of break through when someone might not be forthcoming, mm-hmm. Samantha.
Yeah, those consistent relationships, building relationships with whoever your parenting person is or whoever your child is. It's also easy to say and to blame this individual's parents and say they should have done more, they should have done this, how did they not know? But again, we only know what we know when we know, like in those moments. Yeah. And looking back, I'm sure there are flags and things that they're like, I should have saw that or I might have known that, but I didn't think anything was wrong. So really having a deeper connection, having those one-on-one conversations, checking in regularly if something doesn't seem right and you have that gut feeling, asking more curious questions and wondering about what is going on with that loved one in your life.
And I think, to be blunt about it, there's a a disproportionate issue of this type of violence and rhetoric with young white men. There's a susceptibility. There's no pat answer. I mean, a lot of people talk about sort of hollowed out rural communities, joblessness, all kind, opioids, all kinds of things. And I'm sure there's a lot of overlap. There's not a snug, easy answer here. But that worries me deeply. I mean, I imagine it worries you too, Samantha.
It does. Again, but this is the world that we live in, and really wanting to make sure that those trusted resources that we have. So when we talk about schools, teachers, politicians, educators, neighbors, again, sharing accurate information regarding what racism is, what it isn't, what this looks like as far as an at-large, healthy, connected community, trusted community, what that looks like, making sure individuals have connections. How do we build that? How do we create this safe space for individuals mm-hmm. who are struggling, who find these different places, websites, how they are able to have that safe space to say, I've been looking into this. I'm like, this is what I'm really interested in. And for someone to come and say, tell me more about that. What does that mean? What does that look like to you? And really start to have this conversation and this dialogue.
We're going to talk about coping coming up here, and that is certainly important too. But before that, Jane's been waiting on the phone. Let me grab a phone call. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. You know, a lot of what we're dealing with is so not new. We've always been a violent country, and to get what we wanted have justified violence on foreign grounds as well as on our own. And, of course, we do like a lot of people do. They dress it up into some sort of rescue or heroic thing. Just think, it's recent to me, the Vietnam thing, how we dressed that up, and we had heroes and we just want something, and this is why we get it. But I do recall that there's been studies done on drug gangs, and some of the conclusions were that these boys, and I guess men too, were looking for families in a highly destructive manner. It's not going to meet their needs. It's probably going to kill them. But they have some sort of pseudo logic, I say. It's not real logic, or they wouldn't get into it at all. And people who try to talk to them, I've heard, just hit a dead wall. You will go to prison, or you will die, and it doesn't get through. But I wanted to say that there's got to be a difference between people who have all of these destructive, ill-founded ideas, racism, a difference between them and the ones who act out. However, some of the ones that don't act out have a way, as we've talked about with the media, of provoking it and throwing gasoline on it. And but I remember also that to commit a crime, it always stays in my mind, you have to have a motive, you have to have a means, and you have to have an opportunity. And the motive is often given by the group's leadership and by media, but the means, we have to go back to our guns. But you can be mentally ill and troubled and yet not act out. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jane. There's a lot there. So let me kind of work backwards. Let's start with guns. I don't want people to get the impression that anyone with mental illness is immediately a threat. At the same time, I want to be realistic about what we need to know, particularly with a country that has more than 300 million firearms in circulation. So let's start there. I'll ask both. What do you think, Wendy?
I mean, we know that during a given year, approximately 50 million Americans live with a mental health condition or mental illness, and the vast majority, you know, 99% of them are not doing things like this, or more than 99%, statistically. So, you know, I guess there's that to answer the first question. And then regarding guns, that's a whole other... That's
a very complicated policy question.
It's a big one.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that, Samantha Colson, who's Director of Training and Programs at NAMI Rochester?
Yeah, I am actually pro-weaponry. And I think that at the same time, there needs to be rules and regulations around who and who cannot receive one or be able to purchase one. I do think that they serve a purpose. I don't think all of the weapons that we have in this country do. I don't think there's a need for them. Certain ones are definitely specified and special for war.
You're talking about the kind that was used in Buffalo?
Correct.
Which, by the way, the shooter said, in this country, easy to get and very useful if you want to kill a lot of people. I mean, I don't know. At that point, I asked the state senator who was on the program earlier this week, what's a good reason to have a gun like that, to be allowed to? And he said, well, we can have a conversation about that. We've been having conversations for years.
And you're talking about like the military grade.
It was a Bushmaster XM-15, I think. And, you know, I mean, it's, I don't mean to be sort of like, well, you know, that NPR talk show host never shot a gun in his life. I have. That talk show host doesn't own guns. I don't. And knows nothing about them. I definitely am ignorant in a lot of ways. Like, I'll own that. But I think it's a legitimate question to ask, should people be able to regularly get those things? I mean, look what the guy wrote. Is it a fun recreational thing for people who are responsible? I guess. I guess. I mean, would a rocket launcher be fun if you were responsible? Right. I know people don't like that next jump in logic, but these are the moments. And so that's why when I ask a state senator, like, where are you? And he says, well, let's have the conversation. That's not an answer anymore. We've had it for years. It's okay if his position is, I'm devastated by the tragedy. My view on guns has not changed. Mm-hmm. But just say it. Don't say, let's have a new conversation. What are you going to learn? We are where we are. So I just look at this stuff and I thought, well, surely this will affect some folks. And it usually doesn't. But I'm with Samantha that, you know, we're a country that there will be some firearm ownership. And responsible firearm ownership is important. Mm-hmm. I would never oppose that. But this is a, I don't know, maybe the senator's right. Maybe we need to have a new conversation.
Well, it does seem that and I'm not an expert on mass shootings, but it does seem that these are generally, or at least in the last 10 years, carried out with those military grade mm-hmm. weapons. It's not, you know, a shotgun that I know of. It's not things like that usually. It's these really outlandish weapons.
True. And just to head it off, because someone is going to send me an email in the next 5 minutes to say, you know, the vast majority of gun deaths in this country do not come from weapons like that. True. That there are a lot more people who die via suicide mm-hmm. with a firearm at home. True. Or in interpersonal violence with handguns and not that type of weapon. True. All those things are true. I get it. It's a question of if you want to do incredible, fast, destructive damage, short amount of time, and what's the reason you want to own that thing in the first place? That's it. That's the question.
Yeah.
But I understand that the numbers are the numbers, mm-hmm. and they are real. So, just to save a few emails. and, you know, my mind's open on this. I do want to keep hearing from people. It's just, you know, maybe we're all still kind of hurt by what happened in Buffalo. And after we take our only break, we're going to talk about coping, particularly for the Black community, but for people who are really moved by violence, for people who've lost others to violence. Let's talk about what those needs are with Samantha Colson, Director of Training and Programs at NAMI Rochester, and Whitney Young, Marketing and Events Manager. They've got a big event coming up on Saturday, starting at 9 a.m. at the Village Gate. It's the 10th annual NAMI Rochester Walk and Festival. We'll tell you more about that before the end of the program, too. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by Sean Nelms, the superintendent of East, Upper, and Lower Schools. He is a leader in this community on education, on anti-racism training, and a lot more. But he's also a native of Buffalo. And we're going to talk to him about how this weekend's mass shooting, the racist terrorism, has affected him and where we go from here. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So when we talk about a community that's really hurting, I mean, I certainly think most of us have been shocked and devastated by the tragedy in the last week. But in particular, Samantha Colson, who are you thinking about? And how do you help people who really need some support at a time like this?
Yeah, it starts with checking in with yourself. How dysregulated are you after seeing that? Because we know vicarious trauma is real. So just by hearing these repeated news briefings and being bearing witness just by seeing and hearing and listening to other people's stories, that can create trauma in us and really weigh on us and affect us in ways as well, just like it would affect someone who was right at the scene or experienced it. So really checking in with yourself. Are you starting to experience some of that hypervigilance or wanting to kind of remove yourself from people? So we talk about isolation. Are you feeling dysregulated with eating and sleeping? Are these things that are coming up for you changes that are not normal based off of what you've seen or what you've heard? So you really want to lean into, if that's what's going on, do I need to talk to someone professionally? So we'll start with that. Or can I just check in with those around me? So family, friends, neighbors, people at church, whoever your community is, checking in with them, being able to talk to them about what you're feeling, what's going on, making sure that you are eating and getting enough sleep, making sure that you are able to do the things that you would normally do to take care of yourself. So if that's showering, going for a walk, exercising, hugging and kissing your kids, whatever those things are, leaning more into them around self-care and as we continue to push that connection with other folks.
Okay. Whitney?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, additionally, I'll just sort of speak to what we offer at NAMI Rochester, which is we have a trusted resources page where you can find all of the local resources that you might need at any given time, whether it's, you know, you're feeling like you're in crisis and you need to call 211 Lifeline locally. Or, you know, you can text different crisis lines. We have support groups. So I think it's like Sam said, tuning into yourself and to your loved ones and your circle, figuring out what the need is, and then seeking that support actively.
Do most people who are really hurting, and I mean beyond just sad about events, et cetera, do people tend to ask for help and seek it? Are there signals we should be looking for, Samantha?
So sometimes. It depends on the individual. It's very individualized with who might seek treatment if that was part of their self-care before. So if they have a history of when they feel dysregulated or things aren't going well, they know what works for them, yes. But for some individuals, this is new. They've never experienced anything like this before. They don't know how to respond. And when we talk about stigma, reaching out for that support externally, given their lived experience, might not be the best first step for them, or it might not be something that they're comfortable with doing. So again, as we continue to push these facts and push these resources out there in the community, if you're not comfortable, 211 Lifeline's a great place to start. Just, you can pick up the phone, call someone, talk to them about what's going on. If you're not comfortable with talking to them on the phone, there's the text line. There's also the New York State Emotional Support Helpline. That's Sunday through Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. That's also trained crisis counselors that can kind of talk you through these emotional highs and lows that you might be experiencing because of this. But really pushing those resources for individuals who may not have used them in the past or don't know about them, but also for individuals who do have their normal self-care and repertoire that they do and might just need some extra support, but continuing to push resources that are available.
Okay. And I wish I had remembered exactly the comments. There was a nurse on the program earlier this week. We were talking about the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. and in particular, the under-resourced rural communities, which is in this country, not just in our region, in this country, a huge, huge problem. And one of our guests was saying that if you go to the southern tier of New York, all the way down to the Pennsylvania border, there's entire counties, many, many miles, where there's no mental health services, essentially none. And we've got an opioid crisis. We have an addiction crisis. We had 96,000 overdose deaths in the first year of the pandemic, which was 30,000 more than the previous year. And then last year, we set the record for the most ever in this country. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're talking about what NAMI does, but how far and wide do you go, and what do we need to do to be a region, not just City of Rochester, Monroe County, all the way to the Pennsylvania border or all the way throughout a region? What do we have to do here? Whitney?
I think that's a really great question. I think it's something that we're still, you know, it's a work in progress, mm-hmm. in terms of linking us all together. I will say that we partner with various organizations. So FLOCRA is one of the organizations that we work with, which is out in the Finger Lakes. And so we do try to reach more folks than just like the Monroe County or Rochester area. We also, of note, are part of a national organization, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So, you know, if we, NAMI Rochester, does not reach your area, you're down in the Southern Tier, you can always go to NAMI's website and try to find resources closer to you.
Okay. Anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I would even say for addictions and addiction loss, our region even faced high numbers this last quarter as well. So we're even faced with that again and trying to figure out a path. So as Whitney mentioned, really partnering with other agencies, we partner with Recovery Fitness over on Dewey Avenue to offer an addictions bereavement support group for individuals that have experienced that type of loss. And we not only are we part of the national NAMI, but the state NAMI, and we connect with like AFSP, other suicide prevention coalitions across the state, creating this web so that whatever's going on in Wayne County, we have an idea. And if they need us to do some plug-in services or support, we can do that. Same for Ontario. Same for Chautauqua, even. Like, if we know that folks need us or are struggling and we can provide that support and link up with them, we will do that because we have the flexibility to.
I'm going to read another email. I did this to myself, but let me just try to get this out of the way fast because I knew I'd sort of done this to myself when I mentioned guns. So a listener says, so Evan, one bad guy does something like this and we should take all of those kinds of guns away? Listen, let me just be brief. I will articulate where I am on this and I'll try to do it respectfully because this listener says the vast, vast majority of current gun ownership is safe. True. That's true. Thank goodness that's true. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it doesn't take much, you know, sort of even carelessness for tragedy to happen. What I'm talking about is this. When you say one bad guy does it, we should take all of this kind of guns away. This kind of gun, the kind that he used, what do you need it for? Well, I use it to hunt. You do not need it to hunt. You don't. I've been around hunters. You don't need it. It may make it easier. You don't need it. It's fun. Okay? You don't need it to have fun. There's lots of things that are fun. There's other kinds of firearms you can shoot that might be fun. You don't need it. What I'm saying, there's not a single task that I could think of that you need that thing for that you can't do without it. Unless, as you read the shooter's screed, you do need that type of thing if your goal is to kill a lot of people. That's one thing that pretty much only that thing can do. So if there's something I'm missing that you can't do that's productive or positive or enjoyable, and the only thing you can do it with is that thing, then let me know. I'm definitely interested. But for me, that's the baseline standard here. You can accomplish all kinds of other things with other firearms. I'm not saying take guns away. I'm asking if that thing needs to be in our hands or needs to be mass produced and available everywhere as it is. That's what I'm asking. And maybe I'm missing something. And if I am, please tell me. That's it. Now let's set that aside. Let's do that. Okay. Let's see here. John Paul says, violence is as human as love, isn't it? The problem is we have incredibly sophisticated instruments readily available in the hands of whoever. That's part of my concern. I appreciate that concern. Patrick says, I doubt that white nationalists believe that they have mental illnesses, and I would be willing to bet that many of them lurk within the higher ranks of corporate America or have a good, decent-paying job. Anything like this has to be well-funded, and typically people with mental illnesses, can barely work in many cases. Okay, so let's address that. Mental illness, people with mental illness can barely work. That's not necessarily true. I mean, there are some conditions I think can be debilitating, but that's, as a blanket statement, in many cases not true, right, Whitney?
That's absolutely not true. In fact, our chief operating officer at NAMI Rochester lives with bipolar disorder, is a suicide attempt survivor, and is, you know, one of the most inspirational people I've ever met, very successful, very much thriving. So just as one example, I think it's also worth mentioning that there are millions of functioning, medically healthy Americans who are racist and do not live with a mental illness. Which sort of furthers that point that racism is a core belief that can exist outside of mental illness and it's separate.
Okay. And anything you want to add to Patrick's email there, Samantha, about, you know, mental illness? A lot of people with mental illness can't even work.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know that someone has mental illness just by looking at them. So I think there's also that assumption of, oh, I can point out who lives with a mental illness and who doesn't. You don't. Just like any other illness that individuals might have, whether that's diabetes, heart disease, whatever else someone might suffer from, you wouldn't know that unless they tell you. So yes, there are extremes where individuals that live with particular combinations of things might not be able to work, but that's far unlikely.
Okay. Another listener says, essentially, the reason that people need to be able to own guns is a power differential with the government. The government's authority is solely based on the threat of violence. We already have a massively disproportionate power difference between the state and civilians. We see police abusing authority on an almost daily basis, and the militarization of police around the country is happening. Quite simply put, modern firearms give the citizens some sort of hope against an increasingly authoritarian government and give citizens a force equalizer. That's from Ray. That is dark, but that's the most compelling point made against my idea so far. So I'm listening, Ray. I see. I'm listening. I don't know. I don't know. I'm a naive person. I mentioned earlier this hour. Like, this has been a rough couple of years for me, and I'm like the most advantaged, privileged person who's like ever lived. Which, by the way, like Samantha, like that's like a hard thing for me to kind of get my head around. To like get around, like I'm really not doing great here. And I have no reason not to be doing great. Like, my life is great. I hit the lottery in every way. How can I be down and hurting and persistently trying to pull myself up and out of things? Like, I almost feel guilty about that. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And being in isolation and COVID has really shined a light on that. Like, folks that would typically be fine and things are going fine, this has really sucked a lot out of them. And this is new. There's still being research done as to what, you know, are all the ins and outs of this and how we feel and don't feel and how we will come out of it on the other side, which we're not there yet. But that's why it's important to be checking in with yourself, seeing what you need, checking in with those around you to see what they need to be able to support each other. Because I'm sure for you, you wouldn't be able to do this alone. Like, all of these emotions and feelings that you're having these conversations and discussions with other people to really fill that bucket for you.
Whitney, what do you think here?
I mean, how do you feel about therapy, Evan?
Great.
Do you?
Yeah.
Good.
I need to go to more of it.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. That's
like tomorrow.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I think we all could use, you know, imagine the world would be a much more peaceful place, I think.
And so it's interesting you say this, because I just listened to a podcast with Ezra Klein and Patrick Deneen. Patrick Deneen is a Notre Dame professor who's written a number of books, and he's grown increasingly sort of radicalized as a conservative and says so. And Ezra Klein wanted to sort of probe him, like where's your radicalization come from? And I actually didn't find a lot of what Patrick Deneen said all that persuasive, but it was really interesting to listen. And one of the points that he made that I thought was very interesting, he wants to make divorce very, very hard in this country. So one of his ideas is get rid of no-fault divorce, make people stay married longer. And one of the ideas he likes is a year of free marriage counseling paid for by the government. He says this is something conservatives would sign on for as a social policy to keep marriages together, et cetera. Again, I'm just sharing the thought here. But it was the first time I'd heard a conservative like endorse a really sort of expansive mental health paid for by the government therapy program, et cetera. There's not a formal policy proposal here, but what it said to me was the notion of therapy as a need for people, as a possible benefit, is becoming more widely embraced and I think accepted. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I think there are a lot of shifts happening in terms of making therapy and mental wellness more of a priority and more recognized as, you know, it's just as necessary as the physical health things that we do, you know, the routine checkups and whatnot. So I do think that that's good. It's sort of good to hear. It's kind of a strange way to go about promoting mental health by forcing people to stay in marriages.
Yeah, no, I'm not asking you about that proposal.
Okay.
No,
yeah.
Just the notion, though, that there's more acceptance saying, like, for whatever problem we're dealing with, and for Deneen, the divorce rate's a problem and he wants laws changed and he wants fewer choices for divorce. But he does say, if we do that, like, let's get people more therapy. So it was an interesting point.
I think maybe it should be a year of therapy before you get married. You know, really like weed some of these relationships out.
You know, she's only probably half kidding. Samantha, is there more acceptance of therapy And I'll give you the final word here as we think about it here, because some people feel like they can't access it, hard to pay for. Increasingly, we have different plans at work that will at least give you some option with that. Is that going in a better direction?
All of those things that you just said are true. And yes, I think that there's more acceptance for seeking therapy, for seeking treatment. There is the issue of, I've already tried it. I didn't like this therapist. I already tried this group. I didn't like it. I already tried medication that didn't work for me. I don't have the financial means, all of the combination of things. So I'm just here to offer, if you tried it and you didn't like that therapist or you didn't like that group, there's more. You know, you can try it till you find that right combo. And as far as paying for things, there are lots of places locally that are low cost and no cost that offer treatment. So those things are available.
NAMI always has resources if you need it. And NAMI is N-A-M-I, NAMI Rochester. They've got social media presences all over the place. You get in touch with them, and especially for Saturday. Real quick, Whitney Young, Saturday, one more time, what's coming up?
That's right. We have our 10th annual NAMI Rochester Walk and Festival for Mental Health. It's happening from 9 a.m. to noon at the Village Gate. And we're going to have a lot of fun stuff there. Artists, vendors, live music, and Senator Samra Brouk, who is the chair of the Mental Health Committee, is going to be there as well.
It's an important event for NAMI, and it's a great community of folks if you want to go out and attend. I want to thank our guests for being here. Whitney Young, Marketing and Events Manager at NAMI, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Samantha Colson, Director of Training and Programs at NAMI Rochester. Thank you.
Thank you.
More connections coming up in a moment.